Gosh, thanks, Holly, for sharing that one with us. How appropriate to the word and to the message that we have for today. Years ago, there was a pilot who was practicing high-speed maneuvers in their military jet. It was a fighter. And she had come in low in the middle of a fog bank. She pulled back on the stick. Well, anybody who's kind of sort of been around aircraft knows that when you pull back on the stick, you ought to go up. Only problem was she went straight into the ground. She had lost her orientation. She was inverted, and so she went to the ground. Dallas Willard would tell us that this is a parable of our human existence, especially in these times. Not everyone is exactly crashing, but we do see things going as they shouldn't all around us. We, as individuals and society as a whole, live at high speed, don't we? It is hard to slow down. It's hard to even sit and be still. I mean, really still. Without looking at your phone, without having music on, without the TV going, and a whole other list of things, being still. And sometimes with no clue, as we're clipping along at such high rate of speed, we have no clue whether we're flying upside down or right side up. We don't even stop to think about it. And looking at our culture and its direction, we're haunted by this strong suspicion that with what's happening and what even as we sense in our own heart sometimes, it seems like it might not make any difference whether we're going right side up or upside down. Jesus thought it mattered. It mattered how we travel in this life and how we relate and impact the people around us. Last week we began this new series with the very last parable in the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus has said those who hear and live by his teaching are like a wise man who had built upon the solid rock and had this solid foundation. Now, if we're going to be a little consistent with the pilot's story this morning, to live by Jesus' teaching is to fly by the right orientation, to trust our instruments so that we can live in proper orientation to the earth and the world around us. Now, what would be the instruments? Well, Jesus opens his sermon with the instruments. They're called the Beatitudes. Each of them is a virtue that shapes our living to reflect a life that is properly oriented to the kingdom of God and conveys the kingdom in the world. Jesus states the first two of the Beatitudes, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." Now, these are completely counter to what the world would normally hold up as good and right. But these are not related to, do not have the same disposition to that which created sin and got our race off to a terribly bad start because of one thing: pride. The belief that we know better than God. No, if we are poor in spirit, we recognize our need for God. If we are mourning, we recognize that we are broken and sinful. And we've done ourselves great harm. We've offended, we've hurt the heart of God. And we've hurt others in the midst of our sin. That pride that the world would hold up as and think so highly of blinds us to our real condition. And so these two virtues sound foreign. We scratch our heads and say, "What do you mean, Jesus, that we're blessed if we're poor in spirit?" But that's the reason for these first of two virtues. They exist because of our awareness for our need for God, and that in humbling ourselves before Him, we truly can find comfort and live a life in harmony and peace. Of course, there's much more to glean from the Beatitudes. We're not going to go over all of them this morning. We may well do that later. But I wanted to share those first to give us some context for the parable, for the story, for the illustration that Jesus gives us this morning, found in the 13th verse of the 5th chapter of Matthew, where He says, "You are the salt of the earth." And He goes on to say, what happens when the salt loses its saltiness? It's not good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. Jesus' question really expected only one answer, didn't it? It's not good for anything. It can't be good for anything. Which means that flavor matters. Flavor matters. It's a little bit of a double entendre when I say that. It has a dual meaning. It matters because Jesus is describing a characteristic of being a citizen of the heaven, of the kingdom of heaven. But it also can mean that there are different qualities to that flavor, to the being salty, that we need to look at. Earlier this week, Holly and I met, and we were talking a little bit about the service and trying, you know, putting it together, crafting it, and looking ahead at other services. And she asked innocently about this message, and I shared a little bit about it, and she says, "Oh, it could be like a salt shaker, you know, going shh, shh, shh." And I said, "Well, we'll just see what shakes out." There are four S's that I want to share with you this morning about salt. Our being salt. Our being citizens of the kingdom of heaven, or the kingdom of God in the world today. First is that while salt is used in small quantity in relation to the total volume of what it's added to, it has an impact, doesn't it? It doesn't take much. The authentic disciples are a small number in relation to the whole of the culture that we live in. We can have a great impact. Think about Noah for a moment. I mean, God was looking all over the world, we're told. In Genesis 6:5, so the Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and the Lord regretted that He had ever made human beings on earth. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. That one, he was salty. Same for Lot in the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. How about Mother Teresa in the slums of Calcutta? How about John Wesley, who was sharing the gospel on a tree stump and the open air as miners going to the mine at Bristol, England, heard him before the crack of dawn? We shouldn't think that we have little impact simply because of our relative size or perceived political influence. The truth is, we have great impact on that which is close to us, immediately around us. This I've learned in my ministry over the 40 years that I've been doing it. Do I reach everyone in every congregation? No. But I've reached some. And they've reached others. I also learned that salt can be and is a sanitizer. A sanitizer. It's used for cleansing. It's a preservative. It's rubbed into the meat. For example, you've heard this, that in the day of Jesus, they would rub salt into the meat to slow the decay of the meat. It was also, believe it or not, with a newborn child, even moments after birth, their bodies would be gently rubbed with salt to cleanse the body of all the fluid and afterbirth that there was on it. When we as Jesus' disciples exhibit the virtues that Jesus gives us in the Beatitudes, we act as a cleansing agent. A life that is good and tasteful, a life that in effect kills the bacteria of falsehood and debauchery and all the like, because we stand in such deference to it. We are peculiar, we're different, we're separate. And then we act as a preservative that keeps the culture from decaying further as we are faithful. I mean, you can see it happen in a small group, right? You have a small group of people who are carrying on some kind of coarse conversation. Maybe they're sharing the latest gossip. But a non-believer walks up, and suddenly the flavor, if you will, of the talk changes, doesn't it? If not, changing its whole content. Admittedly, in our day, some are caring less and less, but they are nevertheless struck by our difference. Remove Jesus' disciples from culture and watch it deteriorate. It'll deteriorate into a moral cesspool without hindrance. We're meant to be sanitizer. Salt acts secretly. I mean, by that I mean there's no foam, there's no fuss, there's no froth taking place. It just works its way into the substance that's been put on. I don't mean that we're not to be forthright and we don't give proper witness for the hope that's within us. No, we do that. That's a part of being salty. But I just mean that we can make a better impact on the culture around us when we simply live out the virtues that Jesus has given us rather than demanding that the culture follow along. We have to remember that the day is past when you can assume that a person you've just met knows the story. More than not, people do not know the story of Christ. They do not know what his coming means for them and to them and for them. Some don't even accept Jesus' story. They think of him as a myth. Yet, as we are present and as we live peaceful lives, lives that are aligned with the virtues that Jesus gives us, that is a witness. Salt also acts, you might say, like a chemical spear, because it penetrates whatever it's applied to. When rubbed into the meat, salt's agency keeps it from decaying, and such is how we, as Jesus' disciples, we are sent into the world and intended to bring about transformation through it. It is not accidental that the psalmist said that the children of a believer are like the arrows in the quiver used to penetrate the culture. It's in our, and if you will pardon the nuance, it's in our rubbing elbows with people, with others, that we can be an agent of Christ's good in the lives around us. And it's at this point that Jesus shows us the goal he had in view. What he teaches us, he wants us to teach others. How he blesses us is used to, through us, to bless others. You know, what transformed the Middle East and changed the whole of the Roman Empire was not some decree or some legislation by the Roman Senate. And it wasn't certainly by the military might of any Roman army. What turned the Roman world upside down, what completely undermined the Roman culture so that it was transformed, was simply this: one disciple making another disciple. One disciple making another disciple. This is something I'm going to be focusing on in the months to come. But Jesus gives us two warnings here. If we're being Christ-like salty, we can expect persecution. Back in school, some of us may remember, oh, you're just a goody two-shoes, when you stood up and said, no, this is the right thing to do. But when we are salty, you know, the world recognizes it for what it is. And often, vernacular of our day, in the words we often hear today, we hear them say, we're offended. Okay. You're offended. But that doesn't mean we don't stop being salty. That doesn't mean we stop telling the truth. That doesn't mean that we put aside the virtues Jesus has given us to live by. Because secondly, he says that if that salt that does do that, that salt that loses its integrity, its character, is simply no good for anything. Except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. Man, I would hope that my life would mean something more than that. For centuries, flavorless salt, that salt that wasn't any good, that was meant to be thrown out, they would actually throw it out on the soil of the rooftops. You know, they had flat roofs. and they'd throw it out on the rooftops. And what that old salt would do, it would help harden the soil and then prevent it from leaking. So it maybe had one good use. But I don't want to be among those whose heart is hardened. And the Greek gives here a nuance that Jesus was saying that should give us pause. He was kind of saying this tongue-in-cheek. He said, because the word this translated is that has lost its saltiness, that's one word, is used four times in the New Testament. And its more common meaning is to make or become foolish. Can we miss what Jesus is trying to say here? He's telling us that if we lose our saltiness, we are being fools. We're making fools of ourselves. We're making fools of our lives and of the kingdom. Ouch. Like salt to food, we have to be applied. We have to apply His teaching, His virtues, His way of living to our lives. We have to allow it to shape our lives. It is a discipline that our lives be shaped to look like His. It is a discipline to gain the flavor of Christ in our life because it matters. And I guess this morning I would say this, that Jesus calls you and I to a life that is very different and is a challenge to live. You see, obedience to Jesus makes us salty. And in order to live that life, I would add the fifth S. This one came to mind this morning. Alliteration, you know, is just one of those things we use sometimes to remember things. But the fifth one I would add is this: surrender. As salt is surrendered to wherever we would put it, so may we be surrendered to wherever Christ would place us. He has called you and I to be salt here in Farmington and the surrounding area. Are you salty? Are you salty? Does your life have the flavor of Christ? Now, to have the flavor of Christ, of course, means that you have met Him, that you have become to a place where you're coming to know Him, and you are allowing Him to shape your life, and your life is taking on a very peculiar quality. You're becoming salty. If you have not, then I want to encourage you to meet Him this morning. Say, Lord, I have not. I have not answered the call to live a peculiar life with You. To live a life that will make a difference in this world for the good of the world, for the good of Your kingdom. That will be meaningful to others and transform lives, transform my life. That recognizes that, Lord, I've not always sought to live a life with You. Forgive me. And the truth may be that you've really not sought to be so salty. You've tried to tone it down at times. Well, friends, I want to encourage you to be salty. I mean coarse salt. I mean have an impact. There's a restaurant in town, I won't name it, but they serve chicken fried steak. There's not one in town that matches the quality of chicken fried steak I get at home. But there's one that I've eaten, there's chicken fried steak. But the problem is they make it so salty that if you take the first couple of bites and you're immediately trying to grab water. Don't let that scare you off. Be salty.